Friends and colleagues, my name is Sam Kintzer. I'm not Donald Kelly. Donald was unable to come. I teach French social and cultural history at Northern Illinois University. Our format this afternoon will consist of a brief introduction by myself, the papers in a somewhat different order from that listed in your program, and I'll speak a sentence or two between each one to orient you. Then we hope to have a good half hour or more of discussion with you about the problems raised by our colloquium here. The subject you have noticed is called Ceremonial and the French Constitution. I think all of us sitting up here would question the usefulness of the term constitution as applied to early modern French political developments. And we feel, too, that ceremonial is a term whose present-day overtones trivialize the implications of the royal rituals which our speakers will analyze. As a brief introduction, therefore, I want to say a few words about the general character of the relationship to be discussed this afternoon between ritual actions and the broad principles or norms of political action emergent in early modern France. The basic political problem facing any group of people living together is, of course, how a society can offer the power necessary to organize its collective and individual desires in mutually satisfactory ways while creating at the same time the restraints or bridles in Claude de Seyssel's figure upon that power with its ever-present tendency to turn into a Leviathan. The problem is solved in France and England in the early modern period in paradigmatically different ways. English society develops countervailing representative institutions. Parliament and the king represent in different ways, and also conjunctively the separate and several interests of the society, both material and ideological, secular and Christian. French society develops countervailing legal institutions. The Parlement and their associated legists, the king and his associated officiers, archivists, counselors, embody the transmuted interests of the society, the will of its varied and conflicting parts, as channeled and transformed into legal norms. This French legist tradition, which of course is present in England as well, although not, I think, in the end, the leading thrust of political development there, has an interesting consequence which our speakers deal with in various ways. This consequence is that any single political act by a designated authority, high or low, which in subsequent time achieves importance because of the need for repeated action along the lines of the original political act, tends to be cited not as the singular time-bound act that it was, but as a tradition, a custom from time immemorial, and thus a legal norm. There is, therefore, a constant mutation in the legist political tradition of political will into political ritual. Thus, one meaning of which our speakers may talk, one meaning of this constitutional dimension of ceremony is the tendency to give precise and often short-lived exigencies, such as the minority of a king, like Charles IX, or the heresy of a legitimate successor to the throne, like Henry IV, a general and permanent power by turning them into legal principles. Looked at closely, therefore, and this is the thrust in particular of Professor Jackson's paper, there is perhaps no such thing as a fundamental law or a body of such laws creating a constitution. There are only a set of unique occasions in each of which different legal norms are created in the very effort to accommodate the occasion to a common rule, a legal tradition. What is Achille de Harlay saying in 1586 when he tells King Henry III, "We have two kinds of laws, one the laws and ordinances of kings, the others the ordinances of the kingdom, which are immutable and inviolable, and by which you, Henry III, have mounted the royal throne." Obviously, Harlay is interested in using law as a brake, as a bridle. He concludes, "Thus you must observe the laws of the realm, which cannot be violated without calling into question your own power and sovereignty." But what Harlay is really announcing here is which laws, among the many specific occasions of law, matter most to the corporate body, the political interest which he as a parlementaire represents. Is it then the case that the legist method of constraining and directing political development regularly disguises or transmutes political interests into legal myths and rituals? Is this the consequence of the particular practices that are discussed by our speakers today? The second aspect of my introduction concerns the particular form of the transformations of political will which our speakers are analyzing. The idea that mere ceremonials say things of political consequence. No less an authority than the institutional historian Gaston Zeller, less than half a century ago in his book on 16th century France, could say that nothing would be said in his book of the solemnities in which the majesty of the monarch is manifested before the eyes of the crowd, that is to say, coronations, entrees to cities, lits de justice, and so on, because the details are only of picturesque and anecdotal interest. All of that has changed now. The method of our speakers is one that was made famous at least two generations ago by the German scholars Schramm and Kantorowicz, transferred to American scholarship with signal results by Ralph Giese, with whom our speakers have studied. The strategy chosen is to analyze the symbolic content of ceremonial, of what anthropologists would call ritual acts, for their institutional rather than cultural implications. The obvious advantage of this strategy is that it allows the historian to invoke a set of sources which the constitutional historians of the 19th and early 20th centuries ignored in their search through what legists said they meant and what politicians did. We can now also consider what legists and also what otherwise voiceless royal judges, parlementaires, bureaucrats, artists, guildsmen participating in these rituals felt and imagined they were doing. Thus we are able to see the French polity no longer as statecraft exercised by a few narrowly defined elites, but as a totalizing enterprise in which broad sectors of the populace meet at the city gates, witness to the efficacy of coronations, and create, of course, the varying exigencies, the religious revolutions, the accidents of battle, which politicians and lawyers transform into the ceremonials, which are most of what, perhaps, is rather unreasonably called the French Constitution. Professor Jackson will speak on the subject, coronations and the French Constitution in the 16th century. Professor Jackson.
Thank you. I had the feeling that after Professor Kinzer's introduction that the papers need not be read. They only provide details, and we have to proceed directly to the discussion. However, most of us are being paid by our universities to read papers for some reason or other, and I suspect we have to earn that. The French constitutional thought in the 16th century is a variegated and complicated subject, which is still far from being fully understood, as the other papers of this session will clearly show. Nevertheless, Certain elements of it are clear and have been clear for a long time. Among them is a general recognition in the 16th century that the monarch, whatever his powers and authority, was limited by certain fundamental laws, a tenet which was granted by even the most ardent opponents of proponents of absolutism. A modern historian, William Farr Church, for example, noting the 16th century tendency, again and again gives a very strong impression that two of these laws, hereditary masculine succession to the throne and the inalienability of the royal domain, were agreed upon by all. I single out Church's work as an example, not in order to use his excellent study as a whipping boy, but only to show that certain modifications and long-held views may be necessary. The doctrine of fundamental law is not as clear-cut as would appear from Church's study of 16th century French constitutional thought. And the basic elements of the Renaissance French constitution are incredibly obscure and complicated. Roger Doucet, lists several fundamental laws and admits, and I quote, that there was no unanimous accord about them. The 17th century's proponents of divine right added to the fundamental laws the requirement that the king be Roman Catholic, and this can be quickly disposed of as a kind of fundamental law that may or may not have been. The question of the king's religion did not arise, of course, before the death of Henry III in 1589 and the succession of his father's Huguenot ninth cousin. Henry IV's conversion in the summer of 1593 preceded his coronation in February of 1594, leading not unnaturally to the conclusion by many that it was necessary for the King of France to be Catholic, and in fact the succeeding kings of France were. Not until 1814-15 was there a possibility that the king would be crowned on the model of the Napoleonic coronation in a ceremony which was probably not particularly Catholic, or at least not particularly traditional, but that coronation never took place and the fundamental law never came to be tested. The fact that the kings after 1589 were Catholic may well have contributed to the structure of the French constitution of the old regime, for it was customary to be so, and custom was, I think, the most important single source of law prior to the revolution. I doubt, though, that one could argue that there was a fundamental law requiring that the kings be Catholic, a conclusion which I would support by noting simply that Henry IV was generally recognized as king, both in his own time and in later times, from the time of his predecessor's death, that is, during a period of nearly 4 years when he was not a Catholic. The two fundamental laws which Church emphasized, hereditary succession and inalienability of the domain, may not be dismissed quite so easily. Ralph Giese's knowledge of French public law in the Renaissance is perhaps unsurpassed, and he was consequently cautious when he referred to the fundamental law of succession as the dynastic right to the French throne. Giese showed conclusively that there was no law of succession as such, but that there developed in the later Middle Ages and Renaissance a whole body of juristic thought concerning the subject. The lawyers who studied the subject came uniformly, at least I have not found one who did not, to the conclusion that the eldest surviving son of the ruling house or its nearest surviving cadet line automatically succeeded to the French throne and, ignoring the theoretical implications of the Treaty of 1420, that such had been the case several times in the 14th, 15th, and 16th centuries. François Hautement, whose Franco-Gallia was the first work openly to discuss the issue and its alternatives, came to the conclusion that the French kings thus succeed each other only by force of custom. The right of succession came to be further confused in the 16th century by the coronation ceremony, and numerous historians, antiquarians, and partisan apologists came to the opposing conclusion that the French monarchy was an elective one. The impetus for this development was provided by the reintroduction into the French coronation ceremony of an archaic elective element picked out of 13th century manuscript coronation orders, so that from the coronation of Henry II in 1547 on, there was a ritual consent to the people which implied, or which could be interpreted to imply, which amounted to the same thing in the minds of many, that the King of France could be elected. This position was developed by the Huguenots in the 1570s, and picked up by the Leaguers, of course, in the 1580s and 1590s, when the theory of election entered the actual political arena in the battle over the succession of Henry of Navarre, culminating in the League's Estate General in Paris in 1593. Dynastic succession soon triumphed over elective kingship, of course, and the legal and customary elements in succession relegated the supposed historical ones to a near oblivion, but the issue was touch and go for a period of time, And in the light of the uncertainty of the outcome in the early 1590s, I think that one should hesitate to speak of a fundamental law regarding succession before the conversion, coronation, and general acceptance of Henry IV as the legitimate king of France. In short, if there was such a fundamental law, it belongs, like the law requiring the king to be Catholic, only to the 17th and 18th centuries. The same may be true of the second of the fundamental laws which Professor Church stressed in his study, the inalienability of the royal domain. The development of the law of inalienability has not yet been publicly discussed adequately, in my opinion, and I give here but the briefest summary of my findings. Although the doctrine of inalienability had been developed in canon law and in England and in several other centuries in the 13th century, it was not until after the middle of the 14th century that it came to play a role in French political life. An oath of inalienability was inserted into the king's oath in the coronation order of Charles V, which dates from 1365, 1 year after Charles' coronation, and this oath is by far the most important source for the law of inalienability in France. Unfortunately, for the accepted historical view, that oath was probably inserted into Charles' order only a decade after its composition, and it is highly unlikely that Charles himself swore the oath. Charles VI, on the other hand, probably did, for we know that he used the original manuscript of his father's order for the coronation, now in the British Museum. But he did not make use of the oath until over two decades after his accession, and the Treaty of Troyes could be interpreted as having broken the oath if Charles VI did swear it. From the reign of Charles VII, there are dozens of assertions that the king swore a coronation oath of inalienability. Some of these date even from as late as the 17th century, and not only from the 15th and 16th centuries. However, the complicated history of certain late medieval manuscripts, which is not possible to discuss here, coupled with the surviving records of the 16th century coronations, and an 18th century copy of the signed coronation oath which Henry IV deposited with the Bishop of Chartres at the time of his coronation there, make it clear that none of the kings, with the probable exception of Charles VI, swore at his coronation not to alienate the royal domain. They were doubtless aware of this, and that may account for some of the difficulties which accompanied the development of this fundamental law in France. It was an occasional law only, one to be invoked when useful, as in the Parisian Parlement's discussion of the registration of the Treaty of Madrid of 1526, and the law of inalienability was founded primarily upon an historical myth. This is not to deny that there was no law of inalienability, for the Edict of Moulins, 1566, provided that the domain was inalienable, except in two cases, but this edict falls within the realm of positive law, which is a thing quite different from fundamental law, although it should be noted that, like many of the great 16th and 17th century edicts, it codified to a considerable degree the pre-existing custom. The term fundamental law was used by 16th century writers, and it has often been used since, but the 16th century usage is by Bodin, who is not the most lucid or most exact of thinkers, and others are vague and ambiguous, and the study of the coronation ceremony leads one to conclude that for the period prior to the reign of Henry IV, at least, the term ought to be deleted from the textbooks. The study of the coronation ceremony leads to more than this negative conclusion about the 16th century constitution, though. The king's coronation oath, vague though it was thought by most to have a binding constitutional character. A more specific constitutional element of the coronation ceremony was associated with the bestowal of the ring. Beginning in 1547, at the coronation of Henry II, it was asserted that with this bestowal, the king married his kingdom. And before the end of the century, the lawyers coupled this concept to Roman law, saying that with the marriage, the king received the domain as a dowry, which, according to Roman law, could not be alienated without the consent of the kingdom, his spouse. The fact that Henry IV, who was already king of Navarre at the time of his accession to the French throne, was thus something of a royal bigamist, must not obscure the fact that his double kingship caused lengthy difficulties over the nature of the domain, which was resolved to the advantage of the domain only in 1607. We should also keep in mind that there was a certain kind of popular necessity for a coronation. For most people, a man was not validly king until he had been solemnly consecrated with the sacred chrism and invested with the insignia of kingship and had proven his legitimacy by exercising the God-given power successfully to touch for the king's evil, scrofula. Just as the independent reign of Charles VII did not begin until his coronation in 1429, So did the acceptance of Henry IV not become general until after his coronation at Chartres, for which the more famous conversion may be seen as little more than a precondition. We should recognize, it seems to me, that although the coronation was not constitutively necessary as a legal conditio sine qua non for the kingship, it was constitutionally important, imposing as it did certain limitations upon the king's power and burdening him with certain obligations, and these, coupled with a sort of popular necessity, gave the French coronation ceremony a significance in the 16th century, which it is too easy to underestimate.
One of Ralph Giese's mentors, Theodor Ernst Mommsen, used to scribble on our freshman papers in his history seminars, "Le bon Dieu est dans le détail." And I've discovered the truth of that, that all pith, all substance, even God himself, somehow is discoverable only in details. And so I would hope that Dick understands the things I was saying as a framework for the true pith and substance. It was that was my intention. The royal entree, which is the next subject of our colloquium this afternoon, is studied by Lawrence Bryant, at present finishing his doctorate with Ralph Giese at the University of Iowa. We will do well as we listen to this to remember, and fortunately enough, we have a slide which I think Larry's going to show to us, the function of the royal entree ceremony as spectacle, as a ritual which inculcates emotional effect as well as intellectual ones. It's a very difficult kind of exercise, and I think Larry has brought out it's a kind of exercise in implications in a way that was extremely interesting to me. The difference of studying entrees from studying coronation oaths, funeral ceremonies, which Dick has written on at great length and with considerable profit to me. And it detail. Represents a
what? And detail.
And much detail, of course. It represents an encounter between two still distinct political power formations, the city governments with their special kinds of elites, their own corporate wills, and two elements of the national situation, the courtiers and counselors around the king, and the parlementaire, who are halfway between the two. We had a very interesting discussion about this last night, which perhaps we can bring out again. Lawrence Bryant, then, ceremonial and the French Constitution, Parlement and the shaping of the royal entree ceremony.
This will be a few more details, I think. The point always observed about French royal entries is that by the late Middle Ages they had acquired the form which would endure until the end of the Ancien Régime. By form is usually meant what the 17th century called the order of march, or the carefully ranked files of officials, noblemen, guildsmen, and clergy who went before the king on his day of entry. Form also connotes certain related acts, such as the presentation of the town's keys to the king or the carrying of the canopy. At best, the historical process in which the entry acquired this form has been seen in terms of an unspecified and pervasive monarchical sentiment. For example, Bernard Guenet and François Zahut recently described the increased spectacle and symbolism in the late medieval entrees as trappings to a nascent French nationalism expressed in the festivals of the royal cult. It is possible to be more specific about the process in which the Parisian entry was shaped. As we know, and as we've heard, men expressed or acted out their political roles in ceremony long before they were clearly defined in written theory. Indeed, struggles for power and recognition were frequently articulated in ceremonial forms. My research indicates that a prime mover and major beneficiary in the defining and shaping of the Parisian entry between 1460 and 1560 was the Parlement de Paris. At the same time, the decorations of the entry, of ever increasing elaborateness, came to express political concepts closely associated with the authority of Parlement. I am going to describe Parlement's role in the transformation of the Parisian entry from a medieval or customary reception into a state ceremony, and what this transformation reveals about 16th century political theory. The medieval entry or reception was primarily a legal device by which officials or lords rendered homage to a new king who approved their authority and renewed local charters. For example, in 1350, the Parisian urban officials in their robes of office and the guildsmen in distinctive uniforms greeted the newly crowned King John. In a separate cortege and also wearing specially designed uniforms marched the Italian merchants who had enjoyed special privileges from the previous king. The clergy held another procession before Notre Dame, where the king repeated his coronation promise to preserve the church and clergy. The corporate, legal, and local nature of the reception is evident. The town's government, the foreign merchants, and the clergy went before the king as individual juridical persons who sought to have the new king honor the acts of his predecessors. The ceremony was law-centered, focusing on the preservation of the privileges granted by the previous kings. Even in the 1549 entry of Henry II, the Prévôt des Marchands requested the renewal of Parisian, and I quote, privileges, franchise, exemptions, liberties, and prerogatives, in quotation, before giving the king the keys to the city. The phrases were the language of medieval charters. However, the entry changed dramatically in the 200 years separating John I's reception from that of Henry II. By the 15th century, the several corporations of the city had all united into one urban cortege. In 1431, the Parlement de Paris decided that the best way to receive the king was for each court, college, or university to march as a separate body. Significantly, Louis XI promised during his 1461 entry to preserve the kingdom as well as the church before entering Notre Dame. According to Louis XI's well-known critic and ardent defender of local and corporate liberties, Thomas Bazin, Louis promised, and I quote, to govern and to protect the kingdom and its inhabitants from all loss of their rights and to give full justice, in quotation. For Charles VIII's 1484 entry, a poet went further and noted that the king's promise to maintain the nobles, workers, and merchants of the kingdom in their privileges and to give equal justice to all. Here, the promise was made in regard to estates, or status in the body politic, rather than according to membership in a corporation. In effect, the king promised to preserve the structure of the kingdom, which placed the entry's focus on polity rather than that of individual corporations. The change of focus in the entry from the king's renewal of individual privileges to the preservation of the body politic of France parallels the expansion of royal power in the second half of the 15th century. At this time, the Parisian entry became a device to dramatize the distinctive and predominant position which the Parlement, as agent and guardian of royal justice, occupied in national political society. In 1482, the Parlement had refused to participate in the entry of Louis XI's daughter and son-in-law, the Lady and Lord of Beaujeu, whom the ailing king had designated as regents for the young Dauphin Charles. The Parlement's refusal was because, and I quote, the king had written nothing on the matter, and that the court, which represented the person of the king, would go before no lord or lady excepting the king, queen, and dauphin, in quotation. This refusal to participate in the entry was a thinly disguised protest against the designation of regents without consulting the court. In 1489, the Parliament more fully articulated the claim to represent the king's person and described itself as a mystical body, which was superior to the royal council. The argument of the Parliament's representative, or mystical body, as Ernst Kantorowicz has shown, was rooted in an organological political concept whose constitutional force was to prevent a disproportionate accumulation of power in any one part of the body politic. In 1484, the Parlement de Paris made clear that the court's participation in the entries as a court or as a distinct member of the body politic symbolized its position in government and authority in France. After the post-coronation entry of Charles VIII,
Parlement summoned the Prévôt de Paris and the justices of Châtelet to the court, because these Parisian officials had presented themselves to the king after the Parlement. They were accused of perverting, and I quote, the true order that from all times had customarily been preserved in the Parisian entries, in quotation. The true order, with the Parliament having the honored position of going last before the king, was then registered along with the perverter's admission of usurpation. This register established the precedent for the Parliament's rank in future entries. Indeed, it was referred to more than once in the 16th century and published in several places in the 17th century. The Parliament's assertion of precedence in the entry had greater significance than a simple change in the Irving cortege. It was a virtual declaration of the Parliament's independence from corporate status, which was protected by custom and royal renewals, and an assertion of its unique place in the polity or frame of French government. From this time, the entry's ranks acquired their permanent form, and more important for constitutional history, the ceremony became associated more with the theory of national authority than with the renewal of local liberties and privileges. Precedence in the entry cortege was equated with precedence in the society and government. The Parlement did not create the royal entry, but it did have a hand in transforming the entry into a symbol or ceremony of national authority and of the Parliament's importance in government. In effect, the registers of the 1480s, which defined Parliament's ceremonial rank, put the court into the body politic as a fourth estate. Not only was the Parliament's claim to a share in national authority symbolized in the entry ceremony, but in the 16th century, the claim was dramatized in the decorations for the entry, and particularly those at the point of entrance, the Gate of Saint-Denis. For Henry II's 1549 entry, the gate was designed as a triumphal arch, which should appear. There. On the top of the arch, you see a figure of Francis I dressed as the Gaelic Hercules. This figure was surrounded, or is surrounded, by smaller figures representing labor, clergy, nobility, and law. Golden chains extend from the mouth of Francis I to the ears of his companions. We detect here the humanist myth of the Gaelic Hercules, who led by the force of his wisdom rather than by his physical strength. The arch, appropriately enough, was dedicated to force, as it signified, as the program said, that Paris was the principal strength of the kingdom. It is worth noting that the presentation of force as eloquence and as an urban characteristic is a radical departure from its tradition as an attribute of the nobility. In the arch, the distinctive French form of government, composed of estates and of a successive monarchy, was portrayed allegorically. The estates had appeared before, although without the elevation of the men of law to an estate. The addition of law to the body politic reflected current political thought. We need only think of Claude de Seyssel's virtual separation of the men of justice from the third estate. The Gaelic Hercules was a new model to represent royal virtues in the old tradition of the mirror of princes. A legend beneath the figure had Francis saying, and I quote, by my gentle eloquence and royal goodness, each takes pleasure to honor and to follow me, in quotation. Francis's address to his, and I quote again, true and legitimate successor, which also appeared in a placard on the arch, also called attention to the notion of successive right. The classical style of the arch contained a synthesis of political motifs which had appeared in previous entries. The motifs were appropriate to the theme of the entry, Gaelic antiquity and the revival of arts and letters. They were probably based on the researches of the Parisian officials and planners. For example, Anne de Montmorency had given instructions that Henry II's entry follow the form indicated for the succession of a new king on the death of his father. This was the first such instance of that type of succession since 1484. With this in mind, we should look at previous portal decorations for precedence to the constitutional theme of 1549. In the entrance of Louis XII in 1498 and Charles VIII in 1484, the decorations of the Gate of Saint-Denis portrayed the attributes of an ideal king. In 1484, a royal infant rather than a Gaelic Hercules represented the king. The infant was in a giant lily with six leaves representing royal virtues. These were peace, love, reason, justice, science, and mercy. A legend noted that the king could govern neither well nor securely without these virtues, all of which were resident, of course, in Paris. The dynastic concept was joined to this motif of the royal virtues in 1498. In a triumphal lily appeared a giant portrait of Charles V, the progenitor of Louis XII's dynastic line. Figures which represented nobleness, richness, and power were in the flowers on the right, and on the left were those for humanity, liberality, and fidelity. The legend explained that the legend explained this mystery to mean that the new king came to the throne because he possessed these virtues and because he had the successive right. The French estates, rather than the French king, had been the major subject for the decorations at the Gate of Saint-Denis in other 15th century royal entries. In a silver ship, personages representing the estates of Paris, namely clergy, university, and bourgeois, greeted Henry VI of England in the 1431 entry which preceded his coronation as King of France. On the other hand, the estates of France, that is, the clergy, nobility, and workers, replaced the city's estates in the 1461 post-coronation entry of Louis XI. The estates were in a ship with a royal infant in the crow's nest, an angel supporting his crown. Law and custom also figured in the 1461 decoration, since this ship was between two towers which symbolized justice and equity. The ship, of course, did double service as a symbol of a well-ordered state and as the emblem of Paris. The estates may also have been represented in the 1437 entry of Charles VII in the form of three angels who supported a shield of France. In this decoration, the legend noted that the inhabitants received the king in honor and humility. Finally, the classical style appeared first in the entry of Francis I in 1515. Unfortunately, all that I can find on this decoration is that it was an arch with figures of Alexander, Ulysses, Perseus, and Hercules. According to this brief review of portal decorations, the most striking constitutional innovation in 1549 was the representation among the national estates of the men of law as a separate member of the body politic. In this decoration, the assertion of Parliament in 1482 that it represented the king's person and its claim to a prominent rank in the Order of March was fully articulated. Law was added to the body politic as a sociological and permanent entity. The judges, as agents of the king's duty to preserve the law, had become members of the body politic along with the traditional workers, prayers, and fighters. The representation of the men of law as a fourth estate is highly significant, since 16th century jurists, writing on constitutional matters, assign rights and privileges to estates. Unlike mere corporations, the estate had rights independent of the king's will. The decorations of 1549 reveal, among other things, that the entry ceremony since 1482 had been a means for the Parliament to insinuate and to demonstrate its independent authority as a court in the structure of French government. Through its interpretations of law, through its position as arbitrator of ceremonial rank, and through its knowledge of learning and support of the arts, the Parlement de Paris articulated its version of the French Constitution. Its major message was clear. The Parlement had a permanent and ancient place in the government of France. The form of the royal entry symbolized Parliament's authority and position in government according to the political concept of estates and shared irrevocable rights and privileges. In regard to Parliament and the men of law, the ceremony attested that not only abstract justice, but that the agents of Parliament or parliamentaires were integral to a rightly ordered body politic, claims which entitled this fourth estate to special privileges throughout the Ancien Régime. As an epilogue, it might be well to note further that the medieval characteristics of entries were not forgotten in the 16th century. For example, the Huguenot tract, The Mirror of the Princes, published in 1582, made the claim that France was originally composed of federated and autonomous towns united by a common allegiance to the king, the fatherland, and Christianity. There was no national administration, it was argued, because the people had never given up their liberty to royal governors. Along with the example, favorite Huguenot example, of the reciprocal contract between king and people at the coronation, it was noted, and I quote, "When the king enters into any city or province, he is held to confirm its privileges and to swear that he will maintain its laws and customs. This is strictly observed at Toulouse, at La Rochelle, in Dauphiné, and in Brittany, which cities and provinces have some specific agreements with the king which would be frustrated if the conditions of the contract were not valid," in quotation. This was, of course, a special reconstruction of the medieval renewal between persons to a principle of public law. Such an argument had been successfully used in the Low Countries against Philip II in regards to the Joyeuse Entrée of Brabant. It also had a basis in French law. Barthélemy de Chazenieu had written in his Customs of Burgundy, first published in 1517, that laws accepted by the people and confirmed by the king should not be revoked. He cited the king's promises at their accession and entry to preserve the customs of Burgundy. However, these legal concepts had limited appeal in the 16th and 17th centuries, when personal privileges and public power were increasingly determined by relationship to the king. Clearly, the entry as an example of the limits of royal power did not interest the men of Parliament. They had no desire to limit national or royal authority over society, but rather they sought to demonstrate their body's position and prerogatives in the exercise of that authority. The concept of a legal estate in the 16th century was tied to an office and public function in the body politic. In the Renaissance century, however, the king was not viewed as the embodiment of the state. Rather, as the declarations of 1549 proclaimed, the king was the voice that held the four estates together in one polity. The Parliament's particular function was as yet described in ceremony and allegory more than in a theory of administration headed by an absolute and perpetual 17th century sovereign.
Not everybody was able to read those symbols that Larry projected for us very well in the 16th century. We have a report of the imperial agent in Paris at that time that the simple folk, he says, thought that the king depicted on the top of the monument there with the trails of eloquence from his mouth to the four estates, that actually the king had been depicted eating the four estates. And he was very glad to report that to his imperial master. Sarah Hanley Madden's discoveries about the uses of the lit de justice in the 16th century are no less astonishing than those of Lawrence Bryant about the change in meaning of the entree, and those of Richard Jackson about the myth-making process involved in designating certain laws as fundamental. Sarah is also finishing her thesis in history this year at the University of Iowa, and she will speak to us on the lit de justice in 16th century France, constitutionalism and historical myth.
The lit de justice of the kings of France is one of the most celebrated elements of public law of the Ancien Régime, and conventional knowledge of it still defines it in light of 18th century views, that is, as a ceremonial appearance of the king in Parliament, used chiefly to exercise absolute power, most often, of course, by overriding Parliament's remonstrances. 18th century parliamentaires considered the lit de justice as a constitutional practice, embedded in the pristine past of French history, an assembly in which the king got together various advisors and counseled them on affairs of state. Therefore, they complained bitterly against the quelling of remonstrances in their time as a degeneration of the ancient constitution. To the contrary, however, my own archival research on the history of the lit de justice exposes this view as an historical myth. In the late medieval era, the term lit de justice was used officially only 5 times during the 14th and 15th centuries without any attendant designation to a ceremonial of any constitutional importance. Rather, the lit de justice was a manifestation of the early 16th century, 1527 to be exact, when Francis I held his very pompous assemblies, and they were designated as lit de justice in the registers of Parliament by the clerk of the court and the famous antiquarian Jean Duthier. Still, even by the mid-16th century, the few lit de justice assemblies held by French kings were neither associated with the procedure of remonstrance nor precisely defined as constitutional practice. This indeterminate state was changed a little later, however, by the appearance of two extraordinary lit de justice sessions in 1563 and 1610, both of which were imbued with constitutional significance. This paper will focus on those two events. First, the Lit de Justice of Charles IX, held in 1563, designated in this paper as the majority Lit de Justice, and that of Louis XIII, held in 1610 and designated here as the inaugural Lit de Justice. Each ceremonial, in its own way, dramatized the so-called law of royal succession, one of the, again, as I say, so-called fundamental laws which in effect provided working axioms of government in the 16th century. The majority Lit de Justice of Charles IX was held on August 17, 1563, in the provincial parliament of Rouen. It was the first Lit of Charles' reign and the first in French history of its genre, a celebration marking the king's attaining the legal age of his 14th year, upon which thereafter he could administer the affairs of the kingdom. It was a unique celebration, born amidst the antiquarian historical researches of the 16th century, so well described by Donald Kelly in his Foundations of Historical Scholarship. For instance, by the mid-1560s, Jean Duthier had made available to royal officials his historical memoranda on the so-called ancient practice of the Lit de Justice. Thus, the royal party at this time was armed with an impressive ceremonial tool with which to propagate royal policy. Indeed, royal policy was dramatized there. The first two actions of Charles IX, 1563 assembly, affirmed fundamental law and promulgated national law, thereby demonstrating the role of the monarch as legislator. The third action invoked customary law in a civil case and drew attention to the function of the parlementaires as judges. It was not a coincidence that the legislative power of the monarch and the judicial power of the parliament was delineated in that session, nor that that assembly was held in Rouen. For the principle of the legislator king had already been announced by the famous chancellor, Michel de l'Hôpital, in the 1560s, in opposition to the claim of the parliament of Paris to be an equal partner in the legislative process and the chief of all the parliaments in France. And the royal party chose the newly discovered Lit de Justice ceremonial to enunciate these theories of royal government. More important, the majority Lit de Justice of 1563 provided a public ceremonial expression of the way in which the law of royal succession should be implemented in the case of a minor king. In the ingenious scheme offered by L'Hôpital, one perceives the kind of flux in which the so-called fundamental law operated, that continuous process of decay and growth described by Giese's study on the right to the throne and spoken of here by Richard Jackson in relation to the coronation. The chancellor divided the law of royal succession into two related stages, one stage dealing with the creation or the accession of a king, and the other with the administration of the kingdom. The first of these two moments of succession, the creation of a king, followed a principle enacted by, he said, quote, our forebears, who ordained as a perpetual law that the kingdom is never vacant, but that there is a continuation from king to king, so that as soon as the king's eyes close in death, there is another king, without waiting for coronation, unction, consecration, or any other solemnity. Now, actually, L'Hôpital echoed the traditional theory of legal hereditary succession defined by Jean de Terrouge in the 15th century. That is to say, with the nearest males in line succeeding to the royal dignité by law and not by virtue of personal inheritance. Hence, the 16th century erudite, including L'Hôpital, Jean Duthier, and the rest, also expressed continuity of royal office in legal terms. L'Hôpital's notion, in the passage I just quoted, of the king's eyes closed in death, we call the older legal proverb, the dead opens the eyes of the living. Indeed, he had put forth the same idea earlier in typical 16th century fashion by referring to the medieval law of Cézanne, expressed as death seizes the living, a legal maxim which was further linked with that classic French proverb of succession, le roi ne meurt jamais, the king never dies, and given its best known rendition, you know, by Jean Baudin and Charles Loiseau. Michel de L'Hôpital was quite right in maintaining that in legal terms the kingdom was never without a king, because since 1270, when Louis IX died in Tunis with his son Philip by his side, The new king issued legal documents in his own name long before the coronation, which was delayed, of course, because he was not in the country. Yet this de facto acceptance of legal continuity left a ceremonial interregnum between the actual moment of accession of the new king and his coronation. Now, as Giese has shown, the royal funeral ceremony soon supplied the corrective, because the lifelike effigy of the dead king, dressed in full regalia and treated as if alive by being symbolically fed meals, and this may be the greatest historical discovery of all time, because here this effigy of the dead French king was not only served these nice French meals, but also wine. You see, this may be the very source of this Gaelic obsession with la cuisine française right here in the royal funeral ceremony. In any case, the effigy, being served its meals, having its wine, represented the undying dignité, the office itself. And the successor, king, never appeared publicly until his predecessor's burial, when the new incumbent was finally acclaimed king by the funereal cry, "The king is dead, long live the king." And in this way, the peculiarities, which may even seem a bit bizarre, of that funeral ceremony smoothed over the quasi-interregnum between the death of one king and the coronation of the next, and thus preserved the integrity of the coronation as the first public revelation of the new monarch. Having considered the first stage of the law of royal succession, creation of a king, in traditional terms of legal continuity, L'Hôpital, in 1563, then focused on the second stage of this so-called perpetual law, or fundamental law of succession, the administration of the kingdom. He said, "We call it the law of majority, which makes our king a major at 14 years, and which is unique and not common to laws of other kingdoms and empires." Shifting grounds from the law itself to its ceremonial enactment, the chancellor delivered a bold speech, marking the lit de justice as the ceremonial vehicle for the implementation of the law of majority. At the same time, he denigrated the two traditional ceremonies, the funeral and the coronation. After all, L'Hôpital reasoned, the actual instant of accession to the throne is dolorous because of the recent death of the predecessor king. Likewise, he said, the moment of burial, when the advent of the new king is proclaimed, "King is dead, long live the king," is also tinged with a kind of funereal gloom. And finally, he pointed out, the coronation ceremony is by nature religious and not political, and does not constitute a proper joyous public celebration. In contrast, however, L'Hôpital offered the majority lit de justice, celebration as the true public renewal of kingship. Now, the chancellor's imaginative division of law of royal succession into two stages reflected the historical predilections of those 16th century antiquarians who so assiduously searched the past in order to resuscitate ancient French constitutional principles. For instance, those scholars discovered Charles V's promulgation of that so-called law of majority in 1375 and hastened to include it thereafter as part of the French law of royal succession. Moreover, L'Hôpital's critical comparison favoring the majority lit de justice over the other two traditional ceremonies marked a new departure in ceremonial symbolism by replacing the funeral and the coronation ceremonies as constitutive moments of succession. With the unprecedented majority lit de justice, wherein the monarch first promulgated law, thus given historical grounds on which to stand, the royal party organized a unique majority lit de justice ceremonial in 1563, which publicly announced the rights and the prerogatives of the king. That 1563 majority lit instituted a constitutional practice, rationalized, of course, as custom forever after, observed several times during the Ancien Régime due to the fact that Louis XIV, XV, and XVI all came to the throne as minors. Yet one important factor drained each of those majority lit de justice of the constitutional force so evident in that of 1563. That is, each of the kings, Louis, held an inaugural lit de justice immediately upon their accession and prior to their majority. The first of these was the unprecedented inaugural lit de justice of Louis XIII, held on May 15th in 1610. This is the only example of it, the sole iconographical source. It has many problems as far as the iconography, but I show it here only so that you get an idea of what it was like for that child sitting in the corner at Alida Justice. That Alida Justice was held in the anxious hours of the morning following the assassination, you remember, of Henry IV. And it broke all established rules for the ceremonial comportment of the new king, and its official inaugural tone was pervasive. The 8-year-old child sat enthroned in an assembly of parliament for several hours and personally issued a regency declaration. The harangues given during the ceremonial proliferated with themes of dynastic succession. The cries of "Long live the king," formerly reserved, you remember, for the graveside ceremonial of the dead king, now greeted the live successor as he left the Lady Justice Assembly. In addition, as Lawrence Bryant has shown in his study on entrees, the oath to protect the church, which was usually given by French kings only after the coronation, was given by this child king a few days after his Lady Justice. Finally, Louis XIII was publicly acclaimed as king at the entree to Reims, which preceded his coronation 5 months later. Now, given these departures from ceremonial protocol, it's not surprising to find, woven into the constitutional fabric of the 17th century, a new rationale for the not-so-fundamental law of royal succession. In the same year, 1610, a legist, Nicolas Bergier, discussed French royal succession, but this time in light of the unique and unprecedented 1610 Lady Justice. Although Bergier actually plagiarized, word for word, L'Hôpital's speech on legal continuity, given in 1563, he qualified its meaning by adding a sentence which alleged that the successor king was always, quote, the one recognized as the most near and capable to succeed among males of the royal blood, even if he is still in the womb and not yet born and named. And as a result, there has arisen among us the proverb that the King of France never dies, unquote. In 1563, the Chancellor L'Hôpital drew upon maxims of law to exemplify the legal basis of the law of royal succession, a law later fulfilled at the majority Lady Justice when the king first promulgated legislation in his own right. To the contrary, here, in 1610, Bergier put forth a convoluted version of royal succession which submerged the legal aspect of continuity beneath a full-blown dynastic principle of blood right, a right transferred seminally at conception and ceremonially actualized at the death of the old king when his 8-year-old son held an inaugural Lady Justice and promulgated law before his majority. For the first time in French history, a minor had been instantly and publicly inaugurated as King of France before the funeral of his father and before his own coronation. Consequently, the royal funeral was rendered obsolete and was never held again after the burial of Henry IV. And I often think it must have been a lonely meal that Henry IV was served there as his effigy sat in the same situation. The son is already proclaimed king. And the coronation ceremony, too, was seriously compromised and thereafter included in the ceremonial milieu of succession as a kind of affirmation of the Lady Justice inaugural. The first inaugural Lady Justice was repeated, of course, 1643, Louis XIV, even more bizarre perhaps because he was marched in there and he was only 4 years old. Same thing, promulgating law. At the turn of the century, the 17th century, the shifting sands of quote, fundamental law, accommodated this instant amalgamation of legal power and its ceremonial expression, and ultimately weakened the old legal moorings of royal succession in favor of the high tide of Bourbon dynastic blood right.